Good morning. You're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. LAB Radio is brought to you by the volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Diane, and I will be reading from The Sun. I am joined by Susan, and she will be reading from The Tribune. LAB would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. Okay, headline news, DA drunk trooper allegation known a year ago. Isn't good. An employee at the Middlesex District Attorney's Office said they knew that a state police officer was allegedly intoxicated during a fatal crash more than a year before the officials disclosed the accusation in court, the DA revealed Tuesday. In a bombshell filing with the court, District Attorney Marianne Ryan admits that a non-attorney employee voluntarily disclosed that sometime during the late spring or early summer of 2024, State Police Lieutenant Anthony DeLucia mentioned that he had heard that Sergeant Scott Quigley's blood alcohol content was 0.11 and that Sergeant Quigley, had been at Teresa's with another trooper prior to the crash, the filing said. Teresa's is a bar near the Middlesex Superior Court in Woburn. The Herald reached out to the state police for comment. The revelation that Quigley may have been drinking when he crashed his cruiser into a wheelchair van in December of 2023, injuring a man inside who died at the hospital a month later, initially came to light during a separate murder trial in Lowell. At the time of the disclosures last month, to the DA's office maintained that they were unaware of Quigley's alleged blood alcohol until a few days prior and immediately notified the court and defense. Out of an abundance of caution and in the interest of full transparency, on February 20th, 2026, the district attorney began the process of retaining retired Superior Court Judge Thomas Dreschler to conduct an independent investigation into this matter, Ryan wrote in the disclosure filed with the court on Monday. Earlier on the same day, March 2nd, the employee disclosed a conversation with Lieutenant DeLucia, who also has worked as an investigator in the office. The DA did not disclose who the employee is. The defense has filed a motion to reveal their identity. Quigley had been embedded with the Middlesex District Attorney's Office and was a key investigator in the case against the brothers Billy Bilolium and Chana Fan, who are on trial for the 2020 murder of Tyrone Fett. The Fan trial was in jury selection when the OUI accusation surfaced, pausing the proceedings. Since then, the brothers' defense lawyers have filed a motion for an evidentiary hearing to put Quigley on the stand in an effort to potentially dismiss their case for prosecutorial misconduct. Ryan said that the DA's office would share the findings of the independent investigation with the defense and the court. The Commonwealth is aware that it is within its court's discretion to decide whether an officer's prior misconduct is a critical issue at a trial, Ryan wrote, but contends that much information is generally not admissible for impeachment. The filing came up briefly at a hearing for a different motion in the Fawn case Tuesday afternoon. Excuse me. The judge in that case, Judge Christopher Barry Smith, called the disclosure a pretty important comment, but he noted that the hearing was supposed to be about a motion to compel dash camera footage evidence from the state police. Both the defense and the DA's office said in Tuesday's hearing that they were unaware of the footage from the night of Quigley's crash until the Herald published an article about it last week. By the time Tuesday's hearing took place, the state police had already turned over the dash camera footage, but Judge Barry Smith still ruled for the motion to compel, asking MSP attorney Sheboygan Kelly whether there would be anything else to produce. Can you confirm in some fashion that there's nothing else? Barry Smith asked. All the discovery has now been produced, she replied. In a court filing, the MSP said that the dash camera footage had been inadvertently omitted from a flash drive shared with the DA and the defense. Barry Smith largely veered away from the disclosures made earlier in the day, but asked whether more information like it might come out as a multiple investigation, including an internal affairs inquiry being conducted by the state police and two separate independent investigations start to ramp up. Kelly said that the internal affairs investigation were in a holding pattern, in quotes, while the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office conducts a criminal investigation into Quigley's crash. Both Kelly and Middlesex Assistant District Attorney Casey Sylvia said that the independent investigations launched by their offices will likely not have findings before the Fawn trial is supposed to start up again next month. The judge said that he would wait to rule on whether the state police should be sanctioned for withholding the footage until after evidentiary hearing on motion to dismiss was held. If he does decide to hold a hearing, no one should read anything into it, he said, explaining that for a fine to be levied, it would have to be proven that the evidence was withheld intentionally. Chana Fawn's lawyer, William Dolan, said he believes that the omission was intentional. This is the state police. Of all the cases to make a mistake on, of all the things to leave out, he said, it goes to intent. On Friday, the Commonwealth and defense will argue on the legal merits of an evidentiary hearing diving into the facts around Quigley's crash. I can only get to the bottom of these things if it matters to Commonwealth versus Fawn trial, Barry said, adding that it was important to remember this is the trial of the Commonwealth versus Fawn, not the Commonwealth versus Quigley. Over to you, Susan.
Lawrence. Nearly 40 years after Claire Gravel's body was found off the highway, jurors convicted John Carey of strangling the 20-year-old North Andover woman who was attending Salem State College. Jurors on Tuesday agreed Carey killed Gravel with extreme atrocity and cruelty. The verdict was announced just after 2 p.m. Tuesday, after a trial that spanned several weeks. A guilty verdict for first-degree murder ensures Carey will be in prison for the rest of his life. This was an extraordinary day for justice, Essex County District Attorney Paul Tucker said, praising prosecutors, law enforcement officers, and Gravel's family. Gravel was found strangled to death off Route 128 in Beverly on June 30, 1986. Carey, 67, formerly of Gloucester and Hamilton, was charged with Gravel's murder in 2022 after prosecutors said his DNA was found on a tank top the young woman was wearing when she was found. Prosecutors said Carey strangled the young woman to death with the top for sexual gratification. She was last seen leaving Major Magalisha's bar in Salem, Massachusetts, where she met friends after a softball game. The DNA match didn't occur until after Carey was convicted in a 2007 strangulation attempted murder case and was serving a state prison sentence. He was indicted and arraigned on the murder charge in 2022. Carey has been on trial in Lawrence Superior Court for more than 2 weeks with Judge Jeffrey Karp presiding. Numerous witnesses called by prosecutors were current or retired state troopers, including retired state police Detective Lieutenant Elaine Gill, one of the original investigators into Gravel's death from 1986. She had been on the state police for just 4 years when she investigated Gravel's murder and then followed up on leads for decades. Gill is now the deputy police chief at Merrimack College in North Andover. Jurors also heard testimony from a number of crime scene and forensics experts, including those assigned to the state police crime lab. As part of the trial, jurors also went on a view and were bused to Salem and Beverly to see different sites associated with the trial. Assistant District Attorney Kim Fitella said in her closing argument, the evidence against Carey was clear and convincing. This is his work. This is exactly his work, she told jurors, and the evidence in this case tells you this was his work. What he left behind was his genetic blueprint on the murder weapon. Carey's defense attorney, Mark Booker, pointed to former Beverly police officer James Stapleton, who was questioned and cleared by troopers investigating Gravel's murder. Booker, in his closing argument, said law enforcement did not fairly and thoroughly investigate Stapleton, whose pickup was parked off the highway in the vicinity where Gravel's body was found. Carey, who did not testify in his own defense, has been held at Middleton Jail awaiting this trial. The family of Claire Gravel has waited 40 long years for justice, Tucker said. The prosecutors here today, together with our partners in law enforcement, never gave up on Claire's case, and today we are pleased that at least the family has some answers, some closure. The murder had a profound effect on the cities of Salem and Beverly, as well as North Andover, where Gravel grew up as part of a large family, Tucker said. This hit everybody hard, he noted. Gravel's father, brothers, and other family members attended the trial. On the witness stand, Claire's brother, James Gravel, of Manchester, New Hampshire, remembered Claire fondly as a fun, feisty, and friendly young woman. In 1986, Tucker had just been sworn in as detective on the Salem, Massachusetts Police Department, where he would later serve as chief before his election as district attorney. He said the case was shepherded by three district attorneys, Kevin Burke, Jonathan Bloodgett, and himself. He praised Gill for her tireless dedication to finding justice for Gravel, as well as Kim Fatella, Jessica Strasnick, and David O'Sullivan, who prosecuted the case in court. The verdict also serves as a measure of hope to victims and families with pending cases of any length, Tucker said. The cases are unresolved, but they are never cold. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, I have from the State House, Focus on Fraud has A.G. Girding for another lawsuit. Out of Boston, Attorney General Andrea Campbell says she's prepared to lodge yet another lawsuit against the federal government should the Trump administration's crackdown on medical fraud in Minnesota shift focus to Massachusetts, where public benefits fraud is getting fresh attention. President Donald Trump hinted at a looming clash last week when he put a spotlight on fraud in Massachusetts and other Democratic-led states during his State of the Union address. Federal health officials last week paused $259.5 million in quarterly Medicaid matching funds in Minnesota to prevent payment of questionable claims while further investigation is completed. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services said it may withhold up to $1 billion over the next year should Minnesota fail to clean up its significant program integrity vulnerabilities or demonstrate that the expenditures are allowable. During a television interview that aired Sunday, Campbell was asked whether a similar Medicaid funding freeze would unfold here. MassHealth, the state's Medicare program, accounted for nearly one-third of the budget. Well, if they come for our resources, we will file suit like we have been, Campbell said on WCVB's On the Record program. The AG said her office has filed nearly 50 lawsuits against the Trump administration in hopes of protecting more than $3 billion. Senate Republicans in Massachusetts recently called for an oversight hearing into the public benefit fraud in the SNAP program. In their request to Senate Committee on Post Audit and Oversight Chairman Mark Montigny, the state GOP caucus pointed to $34 million in public benefit fraud identified by Auditor Diana DeSoglio's office over a three-year period, as well as two cases brought by U.S. Attorney Lee Foley. In fiscal 2025 alone, the Bureau of Special Investigations within DeSoglio's office identified roughly $12 million in public benefit fraud. Nearly half of that figure was attributed to MassHealth. DeSoglio's Medicaid audit last week released a report identifying nearly $8.5 million in potential cost savings at MassHealth based on probes into dental services, transportation services, durable medical equipment, providers and inpatient maternity services. MassHealth paid about $521,500 for DME that could not be verified as having been ordered by eligible providers, about $31,700 for DME ordered by providers who are excluded from MassHealth. The report said MassHealth also paid providers $27,400 for equipment ordered for deceased people. MassHealth said it plans to investigate the report's claim and recoup overpayments, and the agency said it will offer training for providers to comply with state and federal laws, according to the report. MassHealth emphasizes that due to the delay in how it receives information about deceased members, it relies on post-pay process to recoup payments for its members who had passed away, the report continued. Trump discussed fraud allegations in Minnesota during his State of the Union address when he declared a war on fraud and also name-dropped Massachusetts. California, Massachusetts, Maine, and many other states are even worse, Trump said. This is the kind of corruption that shreds the fabric of a nation, and we are working on it like you wouldn't believe. Campbell said Trump called out those states as part of his blueprint to weaponize the federal government across Democratic strongholds. Governor Maura Healey posed a $3.5 million increase for the AG's office in fiscal 2027. Campbell is seeking an additional $2.7 million to keep up with the federal legal battles and to tackle accountability voids she sees in Washington. They're not doing some of the public work we're doing, or the health care work, or the Medicaid fraud we're doing, Campbell said. So we have to fill the gap. That means I have to expand my team in order to ensure that folks here in Massachusetts are not defrauded. Over to you, Susan.
Thank you, Diane. Back to the Eagle Tribune. Flag raising marks start of Irish Heritage Month. Smiling eyes in Lawrence. About 40 people shrugged at the cold and attended Monday's celebration of the start of Irish Heritage Month. As if to defy the thermometer, which rested in the 20 to 30 degree range, the sun shone brightly as the Irish flag was raised across from Lawrence City Hall in Campanon Common. To open the ceremony, Ed Hoppy Curran, a Vietnam Army veteran, sang the Irish and American national anthems. After the songs, William Sullivan, who has been president of Division 8 of the Ancient Order of Hibernians for 47 years, and Anne Marie Nahan Daughtry, president of the Division 8 Ladies AOH, conducted the proceedings. Also attending were City Councilors at Large Anna Levy and Selena Reyes, 1st Essex District State Senator Pavel Payono, Lawrence Fire Chief Patrick Delaney, and Police Chief Maurice Aguilar, Irish Woman of the Year Ellen McGugan, and Lieutenant Thomas Murphy, a retired Lawrence police detective, raised the flag with the help of Lawrence Mayor Brian DePenna. To conclude the event, a proclamation from the city was presented to Sullivan by DePenna and Nyan Daughtry. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, Lowell High School students protest ICE deportations. Out of Lowell, a crowd of Lowell High School students participated in a school walkout on Tuesday afternoon, with many holding signs referring what they said was an overreach by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in deporting immigrants. ICE off our streets and ICE not nice rang out in the chants in front of the high school as more than 100 students gathered around and the sound of cowbells filled the air. One student led the chants with a microphone, and many of the students joined in on the chants. We're doing this because we see families getting taken away by ICE agents, said Alia Houth. If only white people were allowed to stay in the country, that's not fair, said Skylar Heng, noting that all of the immigrants who get hauled off are people of color. I personally do this for the families that have their loved ones taken away, said one student who asked to remain anonymous. It's really sad to see people taken from their families. He said he hasn't seen it in person, but sees a video of a woman who was arrested by ICE and taken away from her child, as her child was crying and trying to reach out to its mother. This is because ICE is deporting people from stolen land, because Americans stole it from the Indians, Native American Indians, said another student who asked not to be named, but who pointed out how hypocritical that was. Over to you, Susan.
Thank you, Diane. Back to the Eagle Tribune. Beltran's Boys, HOF, or hires old school legends to guide Puerto Rico in WBC. Fort Myers, Florida. Carlos Beltran was holding court a few feet from the batting cages here at JetBlue Park with two writers, Peter Gammons and yours truly, Bill Burt. That's right, two Hall of Famers and little old me. What started as talking baseball in vintage Gammons form morphed into the sport's biggest problem. In Beltran's opinion, the blending the old and the new. The old is knowledge experience from the legends of the game. The new are represented by those laptops just outside of those batting cages. Beltran is general manager of the Puerto Rican team here for 2 days. Workout Monday and game on Tuesday night for a friendly with the Boston Red Sox. The obvious connection with the team being here in Fort Myers is Red Sox manager Alex Cora, one of the proudest Puerto Ricans of them all. Beltran's team is a long shot, especially when its top three players, Mets Francisco Lindor, Twins Carlos Correa, and Blue Jays Jose Berrios, opted out due to off-season surgeries. Anyway, the eventual winner is expected to be among the big four: USA, Japan, Dominican Republic, or Venezuela. But in terms of coaching, nobody has Beltran's boys beat. He chose future Hall of Fame catcher Yadier Molina, Cardinals, as his manager, Hall of Famer Edgar Martinez, Mariners, and two-time MVP Juan Gonzalez of the Rangers as the hitting coaches, and for good measure, six-time All-Star Sandy Alomar of the Indians as a first base coach. Those former MLB legends alone have 73 years of elite experience. I spoke to the team on Monday, said Beltran. The thing I want them to take from this the most is not only the knowledge they will get in these few weeks, but the relationships. This group of coaches, Beltran told his players, look at them. This is the best of the best. They've been through so much in this sport. Our goal should be, in the end, to remember the relationships. Beltran has seen and heard about the fact that many franchises, including the Red Sox and Yankees, don't really rely on the past knowledge and relationships anymore. I embrace analytics as a tool, absolutely, said Beltran. They can identify problems in a swing. When we were struggling, we'd make adjustments, and adjustments until we figured things out. Sometimes it might be 3 weeks. Now it seems the technology can shorten those slumps. Beltran said one of the key revelations of his career happened over his first six-plus seasons with Kansas City Royals from 1998 through 2004, spending hours with the legend and future Hall of Famer George Brett. He showed me how to be real smooth with the bat, going back and forth, said Beltran, as if he was preparing for a pitch. We weren't the same players. He was a very emotional, intense player. I was more even-keeled, and our swings were different. But that stayed with me and my swing my entire career, said Beltran, I can't tell you how important that was for me. A young player hearing that from a legend. We need more of that today. Beltran said the best argument for what he is saying is literally there for everyone to see. A National Baseball Hall of Fame documentary film, Generations of the Game, narrated by 19 legends. That should be shown in every spring training clubhouse, every minor clubhouse, said Beltran. Our young players need to understand and appreciate the people that came before them. The people running our MLB franchises need to watch it too. It's only about 14 minutes long. I got emotional watching it. Beltran says rather than cast blame, he'd rather be part of the solution. There are guys that will leave this game making $200 million and they will not be inducted into the Hall of Fame, he said. Those guys need to understand the guys before them, the legends like Joe Morgan, George Brett, Nolan Ryan, and they can learn from them too and have relationships that will last a lifetime, said Beltran. That's my favorite part of my career, the relationships. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, keeping with ICE information, Healy, ICE needs a warrant to enter dorms is the title of this article. ICE officers need a judicial warrant to enter dorms or other non-public campus facilities, the governor and attorney general said in a message to Massachusetts students and faculty after an ICE agents allegedly posing as police at Columbia University last week. It's outrageous that ICE agents lied in order to get into a residential building and arrest a Columbian student. But that's par for the course for these untrained federal agents who are doing President Trump's bidding and making us all less safe, said Governor Maura Healey. We want to make sure that students and staff at universities across Massachusetts know their rights. The governor reminded students that federal agents do not have a right to enter any private facility, including dorms, without a judicial warrant, and you have the right to demand one. The state official's message comes after five ICE agents allegedly entered Columbia University-owned residence posing as police searching for a missing child and arrested a student around 6 a.m. Thursday, according to the student's lawyers and Columbia's acting president. Security cameras captured the agents in the hallway, showing pictures of the alleged missing child, the president said. The arrest of neuroscience and political students Eli Aghavia, a senior from Azerbaijani, triggered campus protests, and she was released later Thursday following apparent intervention from President Trump after a conversation with Mayor Zohran Mamdani. Massachusetts AG Andrea Campbell said her office is providing guidance to colleges and universities to help them understand their rights and protect their students, faculty, and staff. The governor issued an executive order to require federal immigration officers to have a warrant for entry to non-public areas and directing higher education institutions to issue staff guidance and policies on immigration interactions in January. The guidance regarding school communities' rights to see a judicial warrant or order from ICE applies to any public or private education or childcare institution, including K-12 schools and colleges, the state official said. Educational entities are encouraged to designate areas within their facilities that are closed to the public and post signs to identify these areas as non-public, like classrooms, offices, and hallways. Private spaces in colleges and universities include dorms, research labs, and offices, the statement said. The Attorney General also directed the public to a, quote, know your rights, unquote, guide to help communities through the basic legal framework of ICE interactions, including the role of local police and how to respond when approached by ICE. Legislation filed by Healy could bar ICE entirely from courtrooms, schools, childcare programs, hospitals, and churches, state officials noted, in addition to measures allowing parents to at risk of deportation to put in arranged guardianship contingencies. When ICE agents enter private campus housing without a signed warrant, that's not lawful enforcement. That's rogue behavior. The law requires a judicial warrant, and people have the right to demand to see it, said Attorney General Campbell. Over to you, Susan.
Thank you, Diane. Back to the Eagle Tribune. Lawmakers urge to lift records exemption. State House reporter, Boston. State Auditor Diana DiZoglio and open government groups are urging lawmakers approve a proposal seeking to pry open Beacon Hill's often secretive proceedings before the question goes to the voters. On Tuesday, the legislature's Special Joint Committee on Initiative Petitions heard testimony on a proposal inching toward the November 3 ballot that would make the governor's office and legislature subject to the state's public records law. Backers of the proposal, which has already cleared several hurdles to the ballot, told lawmakers that making their deliberations subject to the records law is good for the democratic process and would help shake the state's reputation as an outlier on open government. At its core, the initiative is about basic accountability. Jesse Littlewood, campaign director for the Coalition for a Healthy Democracy, told the panel. It simply applies the same public records law that governs every city and town in Massachusetts to the state legislature and the office of the governor. DiZoglio said the proposal would make most records held by the legislature and governor's office subject to request by the media and public. But she said there would be exemptions to protect personal emails, texts, and other correspondence by lawmakers and executive branch officials. We're not asking to view conversations about who's picking up coffee at what time or when their bathroom break is, DiZoglio told the panel. What this bill seeks to do is make basic administrative and business records accessible to the general public. DiZoglio's proposal is one of nearly a dozen referendums inching toward the November 3 ballot. Under the state constitution, the legislature is required to consider the initiative petitions before backers of the referendums must conduct another round of signature gathering. Lawmakers have until May 5 to vote on their proposals. If they don't act, backers would need to submit 12,429 signatures from voters to make the ballot. Massachusetts is the only state in the country where the governor's office, the legislature, and the judiciary all claim that they are exempt from the public records law. This has led open government groups to consistently label its First Amendment protections the weakest in the nation. To be sure, lawmakers have filed bills in the past to open up all three branches of government to the records laws, but they failed to gain traction. Good government groups have regularly urged Governor Maura Healey and legislative leaders to provide more transparency on their inner workings. The state's public records law was overhauled in 2016 to improve citizen access to information and make it harder for state and local governments to shield information. But the legislature decided to leave its own exemption intact, as well as those for the governor's office and courts. Exemptions to public records and open meeting laws mean the state's top elected officials can do much of their work behind closed doors. Democrats, who hold a majority in both the state House of Representatives and Senate, for example, can discuss bills and the state budget behind closed doors. Often no records are kept. The state's open meeting law requires other governmental bodies to allow the public to attend any meeting in which a matter under its jurisdiction is discussed. Lawmakers often convene, then vote to go into closed sessions with little explanation, barring the public and news reporters. Despite our status as the birthplace of American democracy, Massachusetts is consistently ranked among the least transparent state governments in the country. Scotia Hill, executive director of Act en Masse, a group that works on government transparency, told lawmakers Tuesday. The ballot initiative comes as DeSoglio's efforts to audit the legislature, which was approved by 72% of the voters in 2024 election, are tied up in a tangled court fight with Democratic legislative leaders who are refusing to open up their books, claiming the review violates separation of powers. During Tuesday's hearing on the proposal, members of the legislative panel peppered DeSoglio with questions about scope of the proposed overhaul of records laws, many expressing concerns that it would prevent them from helping constituents who reach out to their offices for assistance on often sensitive topics. At one point, DeSoglio got into a testy exchange with Senator Barry Feingold, an Andover Democrat and committee member, over what types of information would be accessible to the public and other entities. Feingold questioned whether the Trump administration would have access to public records related to sensitive closed-door negotiations between lawmakers' colleges over federal funding cuts, if the changes are approved. Would the Trump administration, or frankly anyone, have access to those conversations because they're not constituents, he asked. I'm concerned that the universities wouldn't talk to us if that was out there. I find it disgraceful that you're trying to tie public records reform to the Trump administration right now, DeSoglio said. This has nothing to do with the Trump administration. This is about making public records available to the public. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, Dow withstands plunge as oil prices climb. Out of New York City, this is an Associated Press article. A sell-off for stocks wrapped around the world and hit Wall Street Tuesday, while oil prices climbed even higher on worries about the widening war with Iran. But the big move that rocked markets in the morning eased substantially as the day progressed. By the end of trading, the S&P 500 had sunk 0.9%. That would be a solid loss on a typical day, but the index had been down as much as 2.5% in the morning because of worries that the war may do more sustained damage to the economy than feared. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 403 points or 0.8% after plunging more than 1,200 points earlier in the morning. The NASDAQ Composite paired its loss to 1%. It was just a day earlier that the U.S. stocks opened in the morning with a sharp loss, only to recover all of it and end the day with a tiny gain. Helping to drive that rebound was a record showing that past wars and conflicts in the Middle East have not usually meant long-term pain for U.S. stocks. But that was the caveat that oil prices did not jump too high, like above $100 per gallon. On Tuesday, oil prices rose again and raised more alarms. The price for a barrel of Brent crude, the international standard, briefly leaped above $84. The jump lessened through the day, though, and which helped moderate the losses for stocks. Brent settled at 81.40 cents, up 4.7%. A barrel of benchmark U.S. crude rose 4.7% to $74.56. The move showed oil prices and how much they're set to worsen inflation are among the central fears for investors. More expensive fuel will mean less money for U.S. and other households to spend. It will also raise expenses for companies worldwide, which would likewise hurt their profits. and corporate profits are the lifeblood of stock markets. Tuesday's climb for oil prices came after Iran struck the U.S. embassy in Saudi Arabia, part of a widening of targets that also includes areas critical to the world's oil and natural gas production. Worries are particularly high about the Strait of Hormuz off the coast of Iran, a narrow passageway where roughly a fifth of the world's oil passes. Iranian Brigadier General Ebrahim Jabari, an advisor to the Parliamentary Revolutionary Guard, vowed that any ships that passed through the strait would be set on fire. The fears about oil prices ebbed a bit later in the day, as President Donald Trump said the U.S. Navy would begin escorting tankers through the strait, if necessary, to ensure the free flow of energy to the world. Making things uncertain for markets is the question about how long this war may continue. A major attack by the United States and Israel has already killed Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, but Trump said late Monday night on his social media network, wars can be fought forever and very successfully with the supply of munitions that the United States possesses. Some professional investors said yesterday they don't think this is the beginning of a long-term down market and that stocks could rebound if the war doesn't last that long. But the knowledge it could take a while for that But they acknowledge it could take a while for that to become clear, and Tuesday's swings for markets show how uncertain things are. Tuesday's sell-off start in Asia, where the Kospi stock index in South Korea, a big energy importer, plunged 7.2% as markets reopened after a holiday on Monday. That was its worst day since two summers ago, and it had been setting records recently. Tokyo's Nikkei 225 dropped 3.1%, even as an analyst said, Japan has a sizable stockpile lasting more than 200 days. In Europe, where prices for natural gas have soared because of the war, France's CAC 40 lost 3.5%. On Wall Street, nearly three out of every four stocks within the S&P 500 dropped. Unlike a day before, influential big tech stocks were able to prop up indexes, and Nvidia fell 1.3%. Among the winners on Wall Street was Target, which rose 6.7% after the retailer reported a better profit for the last quarter than analysts expected. All told, the S&P fell 64.99 points to $6,816.63. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 403.51 to $48,501.27, and the NASDAQ composite sank 232.17 to $22,516.69. In the bond market, Treasury yields leaped in the morning with worries about inflation. The yield on the 10-year Treasury briefly rose about 4.10% before pulling back just below 4.6. It was at 4.5 late Monday and just 3.97 on Friday. Higher yields can make it more expensive for U.S. households and businesses to borrow money, affecting everything from mortgages to bond issuances. They also put downward pressure on prices for stocks and all kinds of other investments. When treasuries are paying more in interest than they can undercut the price of gold, which pays its investors nothing. Gold fell 3.5% Tuesday to settle at $5,123.70 per ounce, halting a strong run that had taken it above 5,300 as investors look for safer places to park their money. High inflation could also tie the Federal Reserve's hands and keep it from cutting interest rates. The Fed lowered rates several times last year and indicated more cuts were to come in 2026. That would help boost the economy and job market, but lower rates can also worsen inflation. Traders are now pushing back their forecasts further into the summer for when the Fed could resume cutting rates, according to data from CME Group. That's even though Trump has been calling for Fed officials in angry and personal terms to cut rates now. Over to you, Susan.
Thank you, Diane. In the Eagle Tribune, home invasion suspect wants new attorney. In Andover, a Maine man suspected of a violent home invasion and choking incident downtown last summer is seeking a new public defender in the run-up to a change of plea hearing. Roger Bolins, 25, whose last known address was Augustus, Maine, wants new representation based on claims his current court-appointed attorney has not communicated well with him, according to a February 26 filing in Essex County Superior Court. Bolins was arraigned in October in Superior Court in Salem, Massachusetts, on a dozen charges related to a home invasion and strangulation incident in downtown Andover, which occurred 12 hours apart in July. He was indicted on those charges in September. He pleaded not guilty to all charges, including strangulation, home invasion, and assault with intent to murder someone over the age of 60 via a teleconference from a room at the Essex County House of Correction. The home invasion charges stem from a July 27 incident at 1:17 a.m. where Bolins is accused of attacking a 74-year-old woman inside a Lewis Street apartment. The woman reported a man stood over her while she was sleeping and suffocated her with a pillow. She then reported the man dragged her to the kitchen in the studio apartment where he stomped and kicked her face and beat her head against the floor and refrigerator. He also allegedly attempted to choke a 19-year-old woman inside the bathroom of Karma Restaurant, 209 North Main Street, on July 26, before the woman was able to get away. The choking incident was 12 hours before the home invasion, and the two occurred about half a mile from each other. Bolins admitted to both assaults later in the morning after the alleged home invasion when he was questioned on the incidents that led to his arrest, according to the police report. Bolins requested a new public defender replace defense attorney Valerie Falica, who has represented him in court since August. I have accomplished nothing with my case and have not been informed of any proceedings, Bolins said in a February 17 handwritten statement. He said he was not in possession of any discovery related to the case and felt his public defender did not have his best interest in mind. I feel as though I have been abandoned by my attorney, Bolins said, adding there were irreconcilable differences. He is scheduled for a change of plea hearing in Essex County Superior Court in Salem, Massachusetts, on March 10. Bolins' defense team and prosecutors discussed a potential plea deal in December. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, I've got the five-minute read. Out of Lowell, Riverbed Bend recently announced Dr. Audra Williams as its new medical director, a key leadership role that will guide and strengthen medical care across the organization's residential, outpatient, outreach, and recovery support programs. Williams joins Riverbend with extensive experience in addiction medicine, primary care, and hospital-based treatment, bringing a deep commitment to compassion, evidence-based care for individuals affected by substance use disorder. In her new role, she will oversee the agency's medical services, support clinical quality and innovation, and work closely with staff and community partners to ensure individuals have access to safe, coordinated, and personal-centered treatment. Riverbend's mission has always been to meet people where they are and provide care that honors dignity and recovery, said CEO Michelle Rankin. Dr. Williams brings both clinical expertise and a strong belief in community-based care. Her leadership will help us continue to grow thoughtful, integrated medical services that support long-term recovery. Williams currently serves as medical director of addiction services at Lowell General Hospital, where she leads multidisciplinary teams providing inpatient and outpatient substance use disorder care. Throughout her career, she has helped build and expand bridge clinics, hospital consult services, and medication-assisted treatment programs that connect patients seamlessly from acute care to community recovery support. She previously launched the first addiction consult service at Lawrence General Hospital and has led medical services in both hospitals and outpatient settings. Board certified in both family medicine and addiction medicine, Williams holds a dual doctorate of medicine, master of public health from Tufts University School of Medicine, and is a fellow of the American Society of Addiction Medicine. Her work is focused on improving access to care, reducing stigma, and strengthening systems that help people begin and sustain recovery. Through my work at the Bridge Clinic at Tufts Medical Lowell General Hospital, I was able to work with Riverbend and directly see how they center compassion, relationships, and whole person care, said Williams. Together, we will continue building pathways that make treatment accessible and recovery possible for everyone. Celtic Rock Concert at Taffeta. I don't know what that means. That's part of the next article. Sorry. That should be down more. Start your St. Patrick's Day celebration early with Celtic Rock Concert on Thursday, March 5th at Taffeta Music Hall, 122 Western Avenue. Described as a high-energy fusion of traditional Celtic sounds and modern rock spectacle, Celtic Nova and Walking Finnegan will perform at the show, which starts at 8 p.m. Tickets are $18 and are available for purchase at taffetamusic.com. Also out of Lowell, Western Avenue Studios holds its monthly Open Studios event on Saturday, March 7th from 12 to 5 p.m. at 122 Western Avenue. Join a community-wide artist trading card swap during this month. Open Studios ATCs are miniature original artworks 2.5 by 3.5 inches created in any medium and exchange between artists as the way to share, connect, and collect. Visiting guests are encouraged to bring their own mini artworks to trade directly with Western Avenue artists. Open Studios allows guests to step into working artist studios, meet makers across every medium, and purchase artwork directly from the artists. The event held the first Saturday of each month is free, open to the public, and dog friendly. Please leash your pups. All right, over to you, Susan, for one quickie, and then we're out of here for a little bit.
Thank you, Diane. Back to the Eagle Tribune. Report faults sheriffs for overspending. The State House reporter. In Boston, a scathing new report by the state's top government watchdog accuses county sheriffs of overspending their budgets and demands that Beacon Hill lawmakers fix the broken system. The report released Friday by Inspector General Jeffrey Shapiro claims sheriffs have been overspending their budgets for years with the approval of state leaders without any legal exemption or authorization. The annual spending plans are crafted with the understanding the money will only partially fund their operations, the report claims. The report further states that lawmakers will later true up their budgets with supplemental spending. Regardless of the sheriff's status as elected officials and their office's status as independent agencies, there is no legal authority allowing sheriff's offices to deficit spend. The inspector general wrote, past practice without a statutory exemption is still a violation of state finance law. He emphasized the manner by which sheriff's offices have been funded and that they have spent beyond their appropriation needs to end this year. The Massachusetts Sheriff's Association responded to the report by saying they have been collaboratively engaged with the IG's office during the financial review and appreciate the work undertaken by the IGO's team. The sheriffs will closely review the preliminary report's findings and recommendations and will continue to support efforts that advance transparency and sound fiscal management across the Commonwealth, the group wrote in a statement. But the report comes amid heightened scrutiny of spending by state's 14 county sheriffs by Beacon Hill policymakers. House and Senate budget chiefs withheld $162 million requested by county sheriffs and a supplemental budget to cover costs to their operating budgets in the previous fiscal year amid concerns about the financial and operational integrity of their offices. House and state budget chiefs claim sheriff's offices collectively overspent their appropriations by more than $162 million in the previous fiscal year. The Sheriff's Association disputes the claim, saying the deficit is closer to $95 million based on projected costs, contractual obligations, and the impact of state-mandated initiatives such as no-cost inmate communication, collective bargaining increases, and expanded treatment services. The IG's report said its financial review determined that sheriffs collectively ended the previous fiscal year with a $110 million deficit. The report maintains sheriffs should be provided with a reasonable budget annually to meet their mandate and then held accountable to operate within that constraint. Supplemental funding should be limited to rare, unforeseen circumstances, Shapiro wrote in the report. An effective reform will be one in which the legislature clearly defines the responsibilities and obligations of the sheriffs. Lawmakers have created a new Sheriff Fiscal Oversight Council, which will review the finances of sheriffs on a monthly basis, and a requirement for the IG to conduct regular investigations of spending by the offices. Shapiro's office said the report's findings are preliminary and that it expects and welcomes feedback from all parties as our review continues. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, I think on that note, we're going to take our morning break. We thank you for listening thus far, and we'll be back shortly. We are back, and you are listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. LAB would like to thank you, Mass Lowell's WUML-FM, for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. Okay, Washington, D.C., Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem defended her department's immigration enforcement tactics in front of Senate committee on Tuesday and pushed back against criticism from Democrats who say she wrongly disparaged two protesters killed by federal officers in Minneapolis earlier this year. It was Noem's first congressional appearance since the shooting deaths of the two protesters galvanized widespread opposition to how the Trump administration is executing its mass deportation agenda and centerpiece policy of President Donald Trump's second term. At the time, Noem portrayed the protesters, two U.S. citizens, as agitators, although accounts from local officials and bystanders' video contradicted assertion from her and other administration officials. In one exchange, retiring Republican Senator Thomas Tillis of North Carolina called her leadership a disaster and skewered her handling of the immigration crackdown and her management of emergency response. In the hearing, which stretched nearly 5 hours, Noem defended her agency's treatment of immigrants caught up in enforcement activities and blamed activists and others for attacks against officers. I want to address the dangerous environment that our ICE officers face on the streets today, Noem said. They're facing a serious and escalating threat as a result of deliberate mischaracterizations of their heroic work and rhetoric that demonizes our law enforcement police. Since the deaths in Minneapolis, the administration has taken steps meant to tone down tensions, including drawing down the operation there. But the administration has continued pressing restrictions against both legal and illegal immigration, has been buying up warehouses for immigration detention, and persisting in federal enforcement in areas around the country. Noem said about 650 investigators remain in Minnesota as part of a broader fraud probe. The immigration tactics of Noem's department have triggered a clash in Congress over its routine funding, which remains unresolved. Although a spending bill passed last year granted it a significant infusion of cash for the Republican administration's mass deportation policy. Noem called the partial shutdown reckless and blamed Democrats for a move she said put national security at risk. Her appearance in front of the Judiciary Committee also comes after a weekend shooting at a bar in Texas that is being investigated as a possible act of terrorism, leading to concerns that the escalating conflict in Iran could have repercussions for security in the U.S. In what was initially billed as an effort to root out fraud in Minnesota, Homeland Security sent hundreds of officers from Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Border Protection to the state. They were met by protesters who organized marches, patrolled neighborhoods for ICE activity with whistles, and ferried food to immigrants too afraid to leave their homes. Renee Good, a 37-year-old mother of three, was shot and killed by an ICE officer on January 7th, setting off intense protests demanding an end to the operation. Then, on January 24th, Customs and Border Protection officers opened fire on another Minnesota resident, Alex Preedy, who had been filming enforcement operations. Those deaths led to cries for accountability and transparency. Noem, whose initial comments portrayed both Good and Preedy as the aggressors, had come under withering criticism by Democrats and some Republicans who have called her to resign. Democrats repeatedly questioned Noem about her initial comments and called on her to apologize. You and your agency rushed to brand these victims as, quote, domestic terrorists, said Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, the top Democrat on the committee. We have ample video evidence and eyewitness testimony providing you were wrong. Your statements caused immeasurable pain to these families. Noem said she was relying on information from people on the scene and blamed violent protesters for contributing to the chaos officers encountered. I was getting reports from the ground from agents at the scene, and I would say it was a chaotic scene, she said. After public outrage over the deaths, Trump sent Border Czar Tom Homan to Minneapolis to take control of the operations. Homan has since announced a breakdown of the ICE and CBP officers who had been sent to Minnesota to carry out what had been dubbed Operation Metro Surge, although he's been adamant that President's mass deportation agenda will continue. Noem also faced some Republican criticism. Republicans largely kept the focus on the large number of migrants who came into the country under former President Joe Biden, portraying Noem as the leader of a cleanup effort to the former administration's mess. But she did come under some harsh questioning by members of her own party. Tillis, who also called on Noem to resign following the shooting in Minneapolis, criticized her for erroneously arresting American citizens, for failures in her disaster recovery agency, and for how she shot her own dog. What we've seen in a disaster under your leadership, Miss Noem, a disaster, Tillis said. What we've seen in innocent people getting detained that turn out are American citizens. Tillis, who has already announced that he is not running for another term, added, we're beginning to get the American people to think that deporting people is wrong. It's the exact opposite. The way you're going about deporting them is wrong. Another Republican, Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana, also pushed her to explain why her department paid more than $200 million for an ad campaign she appeared in last year, encouraging migrants to leave the country voluntarily, and questioned whether Trump knew about the price tag ahead of time. Noem, who is set to appear Wednesday in front of the House committee, defended those ads, saying they were effective and went through the regular department bidding process. Well, they were effective in your name recognition, Kennedy said. Over to you, Susan.
Thank you, Diane. Back to the Eagle Tribune. Black Latino Caucus cites Ziegler, local nurse practitioner, in Methuen. On Friday, the Massachusetts Black and Latino Legislative Caucus honored Governor's Counselor Eunice Ziegler and behavioral health care expert Christiana Noe The annual Black Excellence Awards honors people who improve their communities either through public service, healthcare, or civic leadership. According to a press release from the office of State Senator Pavel Payano of Lawrence, Ziegler, who is a first-generation Haitian American, served 6 years on the city council and in 2024 was elected to the governor's council, which is tasked with the review of judicial appointments and advises on pardons and commutations. Through her leadership and advocacy, Eunice has strengthened community partnerships and amplified the voices of residents who too often go unheard, said Rep. Ryan Hamilton of Methuen. So, who is a doctor of nursing practice and board-certified psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner, was recognized for her commitment to care in the region. Her work focuses on improving access to mental health resources and supporting patients navigating behavioral health challenges within diverse communities. As a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner and founder of Focus Point Behavior Health Solutions, she has expanded access to high-quality, culturally responsive care while strengthening families across our community. Rep. Francisco Paulino of Methuen said. So said the recognition was humbling and empowering. It affirms the resilience, dedication, and purpose that have shaped my journey, she said. This honor is not just a personal achievement, but a reminder that excellence rooted in service, perseverance, and community truly matters. Ziegler was nominated by Payano. Hamilton said Ziegler has worked to help families get connected with resources. Eunice's ability to bring people together around common goals has delivered real and lasting results, he said. Her service embodies the very best of civic leadership. Methuen and Haverhill are stronger because of her dedication and her steadfast belief in expanding opportunity from the ground up. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, I'm going to do Today in History and then a quick article right after that. So Today in History, 1789, the Constitution of the United States took effect as the first federal Congress met in New York. In 1801, Thomas Jefferson became the first president to be inaugurated in Washington. In 1865, President Abraham Lincoln was inaugurated for a second term, with the end of the Civil War in sight and just 6 weeks before his assassination. Lincoln declared, with malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the fight as God gave us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we were in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. In 1933, Franklin D. Roosevelt was inaugurated for his first term as president. He was the last U.S. president to be inaugurated on this date. Subsequent inaugurations have been held on January 20th. In his inaugural speech, Roosevelt stated, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." In 1966, John Lennon of the Beatles was quoted in the London Evening Standard as saying, "We're more popular than Jesus now," a comment that caused an angry backlash in the United States. In 1987, President Ronald Reagan addressed the nation on the Iran-Contra affair, acknowledging that his overtures to Iran had deteriorated into an arms-for-hostage deal. In 1998, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that workplace sexual harassment laws are applicable when the offender and victim are one of the same sex. In 2015, the Justice Department cleared Darren Wilson, a white former Ferguson, Missouri police officer, in the fatal shooting of Michael Brown, a black 18-year-old. But it also issued a scathing report calling for sweeping change in city law enforcement practices, which is called discriminatory and unconstitutional. In 2020, daredevil Nick Walenda successfully walked across an 1,800-foot tightrope spanning the active Masaya volcano in Nicaragua. Completing the trip across steel cable is just one over 31 minutes. Okay. Article. Small plane makes emergency landing in the Hudson River. Out of Newburgh, New York, a small plane attempted an emergency landing, crashed into the frigid Hudson River, but the pilot and passenger escaped the wreckage and safely swam to shore, authorities said. The crash occurred Monday night, shortly after the single-engine Cessna 172 took off from Long Island MacArthur Airport in a Ronkonkoma, according to the Federal Aviation Administration. Emergency responders were dispatched to the reported crash site, but initially could not locate the aircraft, the Middle Hope Fire Department reported. However, the plane was spotted a few minutes later in waters off Newburgh, about 62 miles north of Manhattan. The pilot and passenger were being treated at a hospital for undisclosed minor injuries. Their names were not released. It's not clear what caused the crash, which is under investigation by the FAA. Glad those two people survived that. Okay, over to you, Susan.
Thank you, Diane. In the Eagle Tribune in Methuen, city searches for firm to oversee grant requests. Mayor DJ Beauregard is looking to improve the city's chances of winning state, federal, and private dollars. This week, public bidding will close in the search for a grant writing firm. With another tight budget season expected, the goal is to find ways to offset costs without raising taxes. He said he would expect a professional firm to be able to bring in $3 to $4 million a year in additional grants. Beauregard said the job is handled by staff in each department who must juggle the applications with regular work. We need to double down, he said, anything that we can do to provide relief to taxpayers. He said a firm will not replace ongoing work by staff to find grants, but instead oversee applications while also proactively searching for money themselves. Beauregard said the police department has found considerable success writing grants. Beauregard said he had looked at Haverhill's current practices. He said the city pays a firm $8,000 a month to pursue federal grants and another $5,000 a month for a contractor to tackle state grants. The expectation is that when you spend that kind of money, you are getting millions of dollars from that, he said. While the city had allocated money in past years to hire a grant writer, officials had been unable to find a suitable candidate. According to bidding documents, the city expects to award a contract by April 6. The purpose of this RFP is to identify one or more experienced firms to assist the city in identifying, researching, preparing, drafting, and submitting grant applications to federal, state, and private funding sources aligned with the municipal priorities, according to the document. During a January meeting, Beauregard said the city's efforts to build grant writing infrastructure were going slower than he would like. He said an initial plan to hire a contractor had not worked out. He said a Washington, D.C.-based lobbying firm that works with Haverhill would not be able to provide the same services they provide to the neighboring city since both fall in the same congressional district. Beauregard said this left the city with no choice but to go out to bid. Bidding closes Thursday. Also in the Eagle Tribune, Merrimack Valley in a minute. In Haverhill, possible dreams 2026. Team Haverhill's annual community visioning event, Possible Dreams, will be hosted from 7 to 9 p.m. on Monday, March 9, at Northern Essex Community College, 100 Elliott Street. At Possible Dreams, folks reflect and discuss the continuing revitalization of the city of Haverhill. It's a community conversation that gives locals an opportunity to meet new people and discover what the city has to offer. Attendees will meet in the Hartleb Technology Center and form into groups to share and incubate ideas. Some ideas that will be discussed at Possible Dreams 2026 includes a community playground, Haverhill's 250th anniversary, a collectibles show, a large-scale J.G. Whittier statue. These ideas have been collected from the community and will be the topics of discussion at the event. The doors will open at 6:30 p.m. and the conversation begins at 7 p.m. Register for Possible Dreams at teamhaverhill.org. Learn more about the events at teamhaverhill.org. Women's Club meets monthly in Haverhill. The Women's Club has released a schedule of meetings for the next 4 months where guests can enjoy entertainment, eat lunch, and mingle with the members. The club meets monthly at noon on Tuesdays at the Advent Christian Church, 160 Carlton Street. The meeting dates are March 17, April 21, May 19, and June 16. The first meeting will be free of charge, and for attendees interested in joining afterward, it is $40 per year for 10 meetings. The club asks that attendees park in the upper parking lot and enter through the front door of the church to be greeted. Doors are open from 11:20 to 11:45 a.m. Contact President Teresa Gagnon at 978-457-6928 or email tgagnon, tgagnon27 at comcast.net with any questions. Lastly, a Methuen book sale at Nevins Library. Friends of the Nevins Library will host a book sale from noon to 4 p.m. on Sunday, March 29, at 305 Broadway. It is time for the library's annual spring book sale, where folks can browse amongst all of the books, DVDs, puzzles, games, and whatever is available for purchase. The book sale benefits the Friends of the Nevins Library, who support library programming and services. Only the library's Great Hall will be open during these hours, not the rest of the library. Contact Nevins Library at 978-686-4080 for more information about the event. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, I have a commentary. Killing an enemy leader often escalates conflict and chaos. From the Los Angeles Times, the U.S. and Israel gambled on decapitation in Iran, killing Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khomeini and others. History shows the danger of this approach in nationalist conflicts. It often works tactically and fails strategically. Although the weekend's shock and awe bombing campaign and the U.S.-led regime change remind many of Iraq, it's not the most instructive case. That would be Chechnya. On April 21st, 1996, Russian forces executed one of the most precise assassinations of the modern era. The target was Dokhtar Dudayev, leader of Chechnya's separatist war against Moscow. Repeated attempts to locate him had failed. He was mobile and deeply cautious. President Boris Yeltsin requested talks. Dudayev refused. Only after King Hassan II of Morocco agreed to serve as an intermediary in a mediation effort encouraged by the United States, did Dudayev accept a call. As Dudayev spoke on a handheld satellite phone with Moroccan monarch, Russian aircraft waited beyond visual range. Signals intelligence locked onto the phone's emissions. Two missiles honed in. Dudayev was killed instantly. By operational standards, it was flawless. The 100% tactical success turned more on James Bond tricks than Tom Clancy technology. Diplomatic choreography created electronic exposure. Precision weapons did the rest. No ground assault, no Russian casualties, no ambiguity. For air power theorists shaped by the 1991 Persian Gulf War, this was the embodiment of a powerful idea largely refined in U.S. planning circles. Strategic bombing could kill, overthrow, or paralyze enemy leaders and compress wars into days, like the Texas Ranger slogan, "One Riot, One Ranger." They implied promise was one war, one raid. The rationale behind the decapitation assumed regimes are hierarchies. Remove the apex and the structure collapses. In Chechnya, only the first step happened, which was predictable. Nationalism is not stagnant and not hierarchical. It grows after foreign attacks and evolves into more powerful identity coalitions. When U.S. strikes failed to kill Muammar Gaddafi in 1986 or Saddam Hussein numerous times in the 1990s, many air power activists concluded near missiles were the problem. If the leader actually died, the regime would fracture. Russia was a critical U.S. assistant, provided the execution would be perfected. But execution was never the core variable. Leadership assassination in international disputes does not simply remove authority. It redistributes it under emotional mobilization. That is exactly what has begun in Iran. After months of succession planning with the expectation that 86-year-old Khamenei would be assassinated, a top Iranian official said an interim committee would lead the government while a new leader is chosen. This is the pattern after decapitation. Martyrdom transfers legitimacy. The successor must demonstrate resolve, not flexibility. The political market rewards maximalism. Moderate becomes disloyal. Dudayev's death did not fragment resistance. It sanctified it. Power shifted towards commanders less constrained by negotiation and more willing to escalate. Among them was Shamil Basayev. The center narrowed, the emotional intensity widened. The strike succeeded tactically, but was a strategic catastrophe, triggering greater nationalism and violence that fueled years of bloody war with Russia. This is the smart bomb trap. A discrete strike intended to compress a conflict instead transforms its character. Once identity is fused by martyrdom, escalation becomes politically easier. Retaliation broadens. Successors have fewer incentives to compromise and greater incentives to demonstrate defiance. Diplomacy becomes less workable and war far more likely. What began as a precision event evolves into unstable escalation. The phase shift now that the military superpowers can seemingly abduct or kill foreign leaders with precision is not technical, it's political. Iranian leaders prepared structures, succession chains, multiple rungs deep in an anticipation of targeted strikes. Now that Khamenei is dead, there are several plausible possibilities, none necessarily stabilizing. A rapid infusion of nationalist energy within the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, a leadership struggle resolved through nationalist hardening, diffusion of authority across semi-autonomous networks, and expanded activation of Iran's many militant proxies across the region. Each pathway increases escalation risk. All diminish future U.S. control of the situation. Iran is not Iraq in 2023. It's roughly six times larger in territory and five times larger in population. It possesses dense partner networks across the Middle East, capable not only of missile strikes, which begin almost immediately, as Tehran has promised, but also asymmetric retaliation, including targeted operations against leaders allied with the U.S. in the region. Israeli leaders may well be protected from Iranian nationalist plots, but are Saudi Emirates and others who have worked with the Trump administration Decapitation is not a one-sided instrument, nor does the fragmentation guarantee calm. A fractured Iran of nearly 90 million people could produce competing nationalist centers seeking legitimacy through confrontation. The escalatory options available for a martyrdom event are broader than before the strike. Precision warfare promises control, but can clearly educate chaos instead. Escalate chaos instead. The most dangerous outcome of a campaign like the U.S.-Israeli strike is not operational failure, it's operational brilliance, because that is when leaders believe escalation remains under control, just as the conflict crosses the threshold into something far larger. A perfect strike can be the beginning of a much bigger war. Over to you, Susan.
Thank you, Diane. In the Eagle Tribune, child advocate nomination draws mixed testimony. Concord, New Hampshire. A public hearing on Diana Fenton's nomination to become New Hampshire's child advocate drew a mix of criticism and support before the Executive Council on Monday afternoon. Fenton, who currently serves as the chief of the governance unit at the New Hampshire Department of Education, drew fire from critics due to an ongoing legal case in which she is currently the foster parent of a four-year-old after the child, who was taken from his mother in 2024 by Division for Children, Youth, and Families. The child's mother appeared to testify in opposition to Fenton's nomination. In 2015, I joined the Department of Education, where child safety has been my focus ever since. My work gave me the insight that my prosecutorial background alone could not, namely, how to improve the system from within. Before harm occurs, its partnership with the institutions responsible for delivering services to children, Fenton said. She continued that the most important lessons she learned from her time at the Department of Justice was the ability to look at how a system handled a situation and ask, where can we improve this system to better serve? Beyond my professional life, I myself have experienced the foster care system, and I know what it feels like when the services are coordinated and a child feels supported. I've witnessed the success of a child who has received the timely and effective services they need from that perspective, Fenton said. Her husband, Todd Previtt, is a circuit court judge who was formally reprimanded by the Judicial Conduct Committee in November 2024 for asking the court to waive the required background check in the guardianship case. According to an article by the union leader, the JCC found that Previtt violated three canons of judicial conduct for mentioning his position in conversations with court. Executive Counselor David Wheeler asked Fenton what her gut would say if there's an issue with the case her husband is sitting on. Fenton responded that she would be very careful and would speak and seek guidance from the Attorney General's office as it pertains to any potential conflict. She added that if there were a conflict, then she would absolutely address it. Shirley Harianto, the mother of the child under Fenton's case, testified in opposition to her appointment and urged the council not to approve her. I have fought for my son for almost 2 years. I have put my name on my own court papers and filed them with the Supreme Court. I'm not powerful. I'm not connected. I'm just my son's mother. I'm still here and I won't stop. No court order, no nomination, and no court system will ever change that, Harianto said. Rep. Joe Barton, Littleton, also testified in opposition to Fenton's nomination. He cited her marriage to Previtt, saying that her neutrality can be questioned. Rep. Kimberly Rice of Hudson testified in support of Fenton. The child advocate's role is unique. It requires independence, credibility, and the ability to navigate complex systems while always keeping the focus where it belongs, on children who cannot protect themselves. Diana Fenton brings exactly that background over the course of her career. Diana has consistently demonstrated a commitment to public service, and she protected vulnerable people, particularly the children. That combination is exactly what New Hampshire needs in its next child advocate, Rice said. Rep. Melissa Litchfield of Brentwood also testified in support of Fenton and came to speak about her character. She noted that Fenton is close with her community and that one of the things she respects most about her is that I cannot tell you what her political affiliation is. Litchfield continued, saying that Fenton can be the smartest person in the room, but you'd never know it because of how humble she is. Rep. Caitlin Kutob of Windham echoed that sentiment in her testimony of support. She said that Fenton has always been knowledgeable, responsible, and highly professional, adding that her dedication and passion for protecting children make her an ideal candidate. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, so I have the editorial, and obviously it's similar to the commentary. It's involving Iran, but I'm going to read it anyway. A better future for Iran, the death of Ayatollah Khomeini and the promise of freedom. The death of the medieval theocratic dictator of Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini, and diabolical fanatic who pursued nuclear weapons is a moment of celebration that after 40 years of internal tyranny and oppression and external terrorism and war, freedom may finally be at the hand of the people of Iran and peace for their Mideast neighbors, Arabs and Israelis. Khomeini's end came under Israelis' bombs, which, along with the U.S. munitions, have been pummeling the region's leadership, military, and Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, but his death was his own doing. After the 12-day war in June, when U.S. and Israel laid waste to Iran's air defenses, missile systems, and nuclear weapons infrastructure, Khomeini had an opportunity to abandon his aggression and his offensive weapons, but instead he focused on rebuilding his missiles and nukes capabilities. In January, the Iranian people by the millions took to the streets, demanding freedom and an end to dictatorship, which has tormented them since 1979. But they were met with savage brutality, with as many as 30 souls murdered by their own government. President Donald Trump has had his diplomats at the negotiating table with Iran, but the Khomeini regime could not give in on missiles and nukes and terrorism. They had every chance to change their ways, but used the diplomatic process to stall as they sought to restore their weapons. The end came yesterday. In a series of daytime strikes by the U.S. and Israeli targeting Khomeini and other leaders, as well as weapon systems across the country. Iran then launched missiles and drones against Israel and as well as its neighbors Bahrain, Kuwait, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Jordan, and Syria. Hopefully, those are the death throes of the violent regime. Despite the heavy bombing campaign, there will be no vision of Iran by America, invasion of Iran by Americans or Israeli troops to overthrow the clerical regime. That will be up to the Iranian people, but they now have a chance for another popular revolution, 47 years after toppling the Shah. The best outcome could be for democracy to come to Iran and for the country to drop its offensive weapons program. But if the clerical regime of the Mohans survives, or if the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps seizes power, the same international policy must be maintained. Iran cannot have nukes. Iran cannot have offensive ballistic missiles, and Iran cannot foment terrorism abroad. The Iranian people would still suffer such a government, but their neighbors would no longer be under threat. The people of Iran overwhelmingly wanted change and paid for that wish with their lives by the thousands. Now, thanks to America and Israel actions, this is their opening to achieve the dream of change. There is a better life, a path of peace and cooperation. Iran can be rich and a free country. The future of Iran must be up to the people of Iran, not the mullahs. Over to you, Susan.
Thank you, Diane. In the Eagle Tribune, MSPCA seeks homes for surrendered rats. The MSPCA NGEL is seeking homes for dozens of rats following a large surrender from a single property in Essex County. MSPCA NGEL law enforcement removed 163 of the animals from the home February 9. That number is nearly 60% more than the total number of rats the nonprofit adopted out in all of 2025. This is the largest surrender of its kind we've seen in at least 5 years. MSPCA NGEL Animal Protection Division Vice President Mike Kelly, a well-meaning person, got into a tough spot and we were able to help. Given the size of the surrender, the MSPCA NGEL needed to put out a call for support, not just to adopters, but also to fellow animal welfare organizations. As a humane law enforcement department, we want to work with people who love their animals to make sure those animals are getting the care they need, Kylie said. Sometimes that means helping with resources. Other times it means facilitating a surrender, which was the case here. Following their removal from the property, the MSPCA NGEL retained 53 rats for adoption and distributed others to area shelters. We're incredibly fortunate to have many partners who stepped up and took some rats in, Kylie explained, noting that organizations across Massachusetts and New Hampshire helped. In Massachusetts, Dakin Humane Society, Lowell Humane Society, Berkshire Humane Society, and the Animal Rescue League of Boston all took in rats. New Hampshire SPCA and the Animal Rescue League of New Hampshire also took in some of the animals. Taking in so many of one kind of small animal or bird really taxes resources, Kylie expounded. It pulls our attention to accommodating one species when we're caring for so many at the same time. The MSPCA NGEL now has more than 70 rats in its care, nearly three quarters the total the organization adopted out last year. This kind of surrender wouldn't be possible without the amazing support we've received from other shelters, and we're hoping we get a similar level of amazing support from the community, Kylie said. Rats from the Essex County surrender are being split between all four of the MSPCA Angels shelters in Boston, Methuen, Salem, and Centerville on Cape Cod. Usually, NEAS, MSPCA NGEL Northeast Animal Shelter, only houses cats and dogs, but given the size of this case, we had to engage all our locations. Many of the females are on gestation hold, but they'll also be available in the coming weeks. Interested adopters are asked to monitor the MSPCA NGEL's website, as well as those of Dakin Humane, Lowell Humane, Berkshire Humane, ARL Boston, NHSPCA, and ARL New Hampshire to see where rats are available and visit during open hours to adopt. Rats have a bad reputation, but they actually make really great companion pets, Kylie added. They're smart and clean. They also form deep bonds with their owners. Back to you, Diane.
That surprises me. I think they do get a bad rap, but yuck. Okay. Privacy versus transparency regarding puberty. Question. My 11-year-old daughter started her period and asked her mother not to tell me. So she didn't. I found out almost 2 months later. Isn't this something my ex should have told me? If our daughter asked her not to, what's good ex etiquette? Answer. This is a tender situation, and it sits right at the intersection of a child's growing need for privacy and parents' responsibility to co-parent transparently. To be direct, yes, your ex should have told you. Not sharing this information establishes a quiet, you can trust me more dynamic, and that is not good ex etiquette. Let's start with what matters most. Your daughter has reached a significant development milestone. Puberty isn't just a physical change, it's an emotional one. For many children, especially at age 11, asking for privacy isn't about secrecy or exclusion. It's about trying to regain a sense of control over a body that suddenly feels unpredictable and exposed. And yes, part of this is simply that you are dad and a guy, and she likely felt embarrassed having that conversation with you. That isn't personal. What made it personal was that mom chose not to tell you. To be fair, your ex was placed in a difficult position. She may have believed that honoring your daughter's request was the same as protecting her confidence. But this is where good ex etiquette asks parents to distinguish between honoring a child's feelings and withholding important information from the other parent. Remember this, because it will come up again. A child can ask for privacy. A child cannot set the terms of adults co-parenting. Menstruation is not a private diary entry. It is a health and development event that affects medical care, emotional support, and day-to-day parenting. Withholding that information, even with good intention, undermines the co-parenting alliance and unintentionally places the child in the middle. It also gives an 11-year-old control over the flow of parental information, which is not a role children should ever have to manage. Here's the difference in approach now that you are divorced. If you were still together, your daughter would likely have confided in her mother, and mom might have said to you in passing, by the way, Lily started her period, but she's a little embarrassed to talk about it right now. Most dads would understand, respect the moment, and not make a fuss because they are included. After divorce, however, the same moment can shift. What once felt like sharing an intimate parenting responsibility can turn into a feeling of superiority. When parents are together, shared information protects a child's privacy. When parents are apart, withholding it can unintentionally turn that information into currency. I know more about my child than you do, and the purpose of protecting the child is lost. Here's the nuance. Your ex didn't need to share details, commentary, or your daughter's emotional processing. A simple, neutral heads up would have honored both roles. I wanted you to know that our daughter has started her period. She's adjusting and asking for privacy, so I'm keeping details minimal, but I felt it was important that you were aware. As for how you handle this now, resist the urge to confront your daughter or express hurt to her. That would ask her to manage adult emotions, something good ex etiquette cautions against. Instead, focus on restoring safety and openness. You might say, I know your body is changing, and that can feel private. You don't have to tell me everything, but I want you to know I'm here to support you, and I'm not uncomfortable talking about these things if you ever want to. Separately, address this with your ex. Calmly, attach it to co-parenting, not blame. I understand why you wanted to protect her wishes. Going forward, I need to be informed about major health and development changes so I can support her appropriately. That's not an accusation. It's a boundary. Good ex etiquette isn't about forcing children to share more than they're ready for. It's about adults sharing enough with each other so children don't have to manage the divide. When parents handle milestones collaboratively, children feel protected, not exposed. That's exactly what this stage of development requires. That's good ex etiquette. And on that note, we're going to wrap up for today. Thank you for listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to LAB Radio. Request a free specialized radio receiver, or for more information about our radio reading services, call LAB at 978-454-5704. You can listen to LAB Radio anytime by dialing 9069, wrong one. Visit our website where you can tune into LAB Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. This has been Diane and Susan. We thank you for listening. I think it's going to be nice outside, so if you can get out today, even for half an hour and just breathe some fresh air and take a walk, it would be lovely to clear your mind and your soul. And if you can't, enjoy at least the sunshine through your windows. whatever you do this evening, enjoy it, be safe, and be kind to one another. Have a great evening, everyone.